Welcome to the Weekly Leader Podcast, episode 21. I'm Peter Mello from Seafever Consulting and the founder and editor of the Weekly Leader website and podcast. And my podcasting partner, as usual, is Pam Fox Rollin from IdeaShape. Hi, Pam. How are you today?
Good, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing really well, Pam. We have a great interview today that you did and some other great material. Do you have any thoughts?
I had so much fun talking with Fran Meyer, the CEO of Trustee, and I'm really looking forward to putting the interview up there. So
she was our first woman weekly leader, I believe. Isn't that right?
That is.
Yeah. So that's exciting. Quick shout out. Actually, it's just a kind of a recognition that somebody shouted out to us. TerribleTed666, he did a review on, I believe he did a review on iTunes, and then he shouted out to Twitter on Twitter about our mention about that last week. And then Becky Robinson from Leader Talk appreciated being our website of the week two podcasts ago, because last week we had a special video podcast, the Mario Vitone's closing keynote at the Coast Guard conference on human technology performance, I think is what it was, in Williamsburg, Virginia. And if you haven't seen that, definitely take a look at it. It's a great video. It lasts about 45 minutes, a little long, but Mario is a good presenter. I kind of joke that he's the Tony Robbins of the United States Coast Guard. Things in the news, Pam. Something happened this week, or I guess it was probably last week, that just kind of got my attention a lot, and that was President Obama getting into the Olympic process, promoting his hometown, Chicago. What was that, 2016, I think, is when it was going to be. Flew over to Europe for the meeting and came away. We didn't get it. In fact, we finished last of four candidates. I was just taken about the fact that he has some, you know, as a leader, any kind of leader has limited bandwidth. And I just wondered if this was something he really should have focused time and effort on. Did you have any thoughts? So what were your kind of impressions about that whole thing that happened?
I was ambivalent. And I don't know if this was the same ambivalence that you had or where you came on it. But I was glad that he was representing the U.S. And I'm always glad to see him be the face of the U.S. because I think he does very well with that and strikes notes that are useful. I'm not sure it was the highest priority for his time and effort. And it's always a tough situation for a leader when you put yourself out and then it fails. And so part of me was wondering whether that was squandering his presence, which is already getting, you know, spread a little thin. And part of me was appreciating that he took a risk in putting himself out there.
Yeah, I think I'm in agreement. I think, you know, he obviously took a risk. It's just you have to figure out whether or not that risk is one that you really want to put forward. I don't know. Our weekly leader this week has a couple interesting stories about how I think she prepared for some big events in her career. And it just seemed like this was one where maybe it wasn't prepared for, you know, to have the president engage in the process and then finish last. Seems like maybe a lot of homework wasn't done beforehand to figure out whether or not it would be a successful trip, because it obviously gives the other side an opportunity, opens up a window of opportunity to criticize too. So anyway, it's an interesting thing. I don't think it's hurt him at all in the in his polls, but I just thought it was maybe kind of misguided or misplaced at this point in our country's current state.
You know, I think that's exactly it. I think it's a question of timing, and one is about the country's state, and the other is about where he is in the arc of his journey, which is very new. But it's also a really vulnerable time, and people are wondering if he's going to pull off some tremendously important things, most notably healthcare, as well as financial regulation and all that sort of stuff. And to have a lose about something that was inconsequential at a point when he hasn't yet consolidated gains seems extra risky to me.
Yeah, agreed. Well, good. Well, let's just jump right into our website of the week. I picked a website of the week that I really enjoy. I've been following this website for quite a while. It's 1-800-CEO-READ. And it sounds kind of like an infomercial, but it's a great website. They have the website itself is 800ceoread.com, and they have a blog over there. And what they do is they talk about business books. And in fact, the founder of the website and one of his colleagues wrote a book called The 100 Best Business Books of All Time. Jack Covert and Todd Satterston are the authors of that, and they're pretty much the behind the website here. So if you're interested in business books, this is definitely a place that you want to check out. They review books. And they also have this fun little thing called In Bubble Wrap, which is one of these microsites. It's basically a single-purpose site, and every week, I guess it's every week, they have a little contest where they give away business books and prizes and things. And I have actually been lucky enough to have been the recipient of some books from them on a number of occasions. So it's definitely worth checking out. Check out the website and the blog as well. Have you been over there?
Just since your recommendation. And you find terrific stuff, Peter. So I am looking forward to delving into the site.
Yeah, they do a podcast as well, which is right there on the website, so you can listen to it right there. Actually, it's hidden down on the left-hand side. There's a little player built into the website. It pops right out and will play the podcast right in the middle of the webpage. You'll see recent audio. They have some video up there. So anyway, check it out, 1-800-CEO-READ. And talking about websites, we have a soft kind of redesign of our website. It's about 75% there. We've changed a few things, and we'll be talking a little bit more about that maybe the next episode and give people a tour of it. Your research finding of the week, what do you got?
Okay, research report of the week is fresh working paper put up this week at the MIT Sloan School of Management. Actually put up a couple weeks ago. And it is about multiple team membership. So serving on multiple teams in an organization. And it's called A Theoretical Model of Its Effects on Productivity and Learning for Individuals, Teams, and Organizations. It's by Michael Boyer O'Leary, Mark Mortensen, and Anita Woolley, all of the MIT Sloan School of Management. And I picked it for a couple reasons. One is I really want to encourage our listeners to check out the working papers at their favorite academic institution, because most of the major business schools and also social psychology departments, engineering departments, and other places that you that might be linked to your area that you're interested in have sites where they put up working papers for free. And when the papers are in the final form and have been published in the journal, you have to pay $30 a pop on something. But if you go look for working papers, you get to see the freshest thinking, you get to see it for free, and you get to see it from some of your favorite professors and industry groups. So I'd encourage you, if you don't know as a leader which academics are doing work that is of interest to you, do some searches, go on to Google Scholar, find the names of the people and institutions where they are that specialize in what you're most interested in, and then go back to those institutions' websites and look for working papers. So that was one reason I picked it. The second reason is that the reality is that more and more knowledge workers are serving on teams. And some studies that have been done over the last couple of years show that simultaneous membership on more than one team, what they call MTM, multiple team membership, appears to be the norm for at least 65% of knowledge workers in the United States and Europe. That's huge.
Wow.
And in a survey of Intel, they found that 28% of people are on five or more teams. And yet this is an area that really hasn't had a lot of research. Now, it's not new. And I remember going back to the strategy from Bain & Company, where I started my career 22 years ago, we were always on two project cases. And the benefits of that are the same benefits that are cited in this study, that it allows you to take advantage of natural slack times and heavy times that are in the course of any project, so that you can handle that workload and distribute the workload so that you're always busy. And also that you learn more rapidly, because if you're on a project for 6 to 9 months, whether you're in a consulting firm or in industry on a team, if you're on two at the same time, chances are you're learning about two different problems and issues at the same time. The challenges, of course, flow from that and are predictable. People are overstressed, overworked, unclear on priorities, feeling pressure from all sides. And this is an area that really hasn't been studied much. So I was very glad to see this fresh thinking from it. It's a long article, as many of these academic articles are, but working papers tend to be somewhere from 30 to 70 pages, and this is on the long side of that. But you can always just start at the beginning at the abstract and introduction, and then go down to the discussion and conclusions at the end. And I'll just highlight to you, they had 6 findings so far, and I'll add a 7th, about how to improve the effectiveness and performance of people who are on multiple teams. So the first is managers have to know what other teams their people are on. This sounds so obvious, but I can assure you that it's not always true. Second is to have schedules and practices that help people with context switching. We've talked before in a podcast about multitasking and about the challenge of going back and forth between different situations. So there are some ways to give people long enough chunks of time on a project that they can actually focus. Third is to define your different roles on the team. Is this person core or peripheral to the team? Are they in a consulting advisory role? Are they a major contributor? Do they come in at the end of the decision-making process? Are they providing data that needs to happen at the beginning? This, again, sounds really obvious, and I can say from personal experience that it doesn't always happen. Fourth, to understand what is it about individuals and what is it about project structures that tend to make something like this work? And there's more research that's needed there. The fifth is that they're finding, or that they believe that giving people some choice about how many teams to be on and which teams to be on is important. It runs the risk for some people of volunteering for too many teams. But as with most things in life, if people choose to do it, they tend to be more committed to it. Sixth, and their final recommendation, is early, honest dialogue about people's goals. And I'll add to that, is to figure out how performance will be evaluated. And again, this sounds really basic, but I work with a number of clients who are on multiple initiatives, often spanning the globe, spanning different parts of the business. And they're, you know, mid-level executives in companies, and there's no match between their performance eval system, their visibility kind of formally in the company, succession planning, and compensation with this multiple team structure. So this multiple team structure has emerged over the last couple of years, and those other systems haven't kept pace with it, and it creates conflict for people who really want to race towards their goals and also reap the rewards and their compensation. That is the research report of the week.
So is this research what we would traditionally call the matrix management issues that come out in very often larger corporations?
It may be in some organizations, but not necessarily, and typically not in the organizations that I'm working with. So we think of a matrix, you know, as people were writing about it and experiencing it 20, 30 years ago, where you may have a reporting relationship up through a product line and then a reporting relationship to a function. What's now happening that I see in organizations is much more fluid, is shorter periods of duration. So in a matrix organization, you might have those same reporting relationships for years and years. Here, there's an initiative to do green manufacturing. There's an initiative to figure out social media for a particular product line. There is an initiative to source more globally and cut production costs. And people are on an initiative for a certain period of typically months. And it's that sort of compressed time period and the rapidity of change that I think has caused the mismatch between that and systems of performance evaluation, development, and compensation.
Another good piece of information for our listeners. Thank you. This week we have Fran Meyer, who is the CEO of Trustee.com, and she's our first woman weekly leader. Very exciting to have her on. It's a fantastic interview you did with her, Pam, so let's give it a listen.
so hard to tell. Who, who means you well? And when you guess wrong, pace corridors all night long. You, you gave me your word, and all the colors got blurred. It broke on a whim. Here is where jaded begins. Oh, and I do not know who to trust anymore. I have grown weary of opening doors. I am so tired of being naive and unsure of who to trust.
We're with Fran Meyer, CEO of Trustee. Fran, thank you for joining us on Weekly Leader.
Real pleasure to be here today.
Thanks. Well, you and I know each other through alumni initiatives at Stanford Business School. Our listeners probably know you best through the two online companies you've built, Match.com and Trustee. Fill in our listeners on who you are and what you do.
Well, thanks, Pam, for remembering all that. I've had a really wonderful career and have been involved in new media and internet really since late 1994 when I joined Match.com, which at that point was really a proof of concept for online classifieds. And over the next few years, really emerged as the first big brand in online dating. Funny thing, if you go back then, we saw it, and unfortunately the board saw it, as sort of a side activity, a side business, and a proof of concept. And we ended up selling it for way too little. And, you know, timing is everything. We were a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of the importance of brand and the importance of community on the Internet. I'm talking about 1997 at this point.
And the irony is you built that. You built that brand and you built that community, and it may have been too early for everyone to understand.
Yeah, I think too early. There was a little bit of a downturn before the big bubble in 98 and 99, and the board members saw it as personals and didn't understand that what we were doing was building not only a new business category called online dating, which is really different in so many ways from newspaper personals, but also building a rite of passage, essentially, that if you talk to young people now, and if you look on YouTube, I just saw this, you know, one of those YouTube Do You Know things that talks about trends and what's happening in the whole wide world. Something like 1 in 6 marriages started online. And I saw that, and I was amazed and proud, and my son looked at me and said, "You had something to do with that, didn't you?"
So that
was just fabulous.
I remember exactly where I was when one of my friends from Stanford Business School, we were in the library our last quarter, and this is 15 years ago, 14 years ago, and she said, "Pam, I'm signing you up on Match.com."
And how'd it go for you, Pam?
We're going to hook you up with somebody great. It was a hilarious 6 months, and several years later, I met my now wonderful husband through my freshman year roommate from college.
Well, no, that's great. But, you know, one of the things we learned early on, and I think actually things have changed. I don't know if I can show you the proof of it, but people were sort of in dating ruts, and now because of online dating, they sort of have no excuse to date, not to date.
Right.
Right. So really, like I said, it wasn't just a whole new business category, but a rite of passage.
So we've been talking about the business side of it, and I'm wondering what impact that had on you as a leader and in thinking about what you could do to have that experience early on, just since the start of this boom?
You know, it's had an incredible impact. Back in the mid-90s, I was a young mom, married, two children. They were very young at the time, and now they're much older. Time flies fast. To be part of the birth of the consumer internet and to be involved in this for the last 15, well, however many years we're at now, has just been a life-changing thing for me in so many ways. And it has so much less to do with stock options and bubbles and busts, although clearly going through those kind of machinations and understanding that being at the right place, right company, right time can make all the difference. That's all been interesting, but really what's been interesting is dealing with the growth of a paradigm-changing industry at a time of a change of century and seeing how it's impacted all of our lives and dealing with the issues that it's brought with us. And you know, obviously one of those issues has been the issue of privacy and trust online. Very early was something that people, companies, individuals, commentators, journalists were commenting on, is that trust is becoming a currency now in a way that it was never before.
So you went from Match.com. Were you looking for a specific sort of leadership opportunity after that?
You know, Match.com was sold and they were going to move it to Texas, and I wanted to stay in the Bay Area for a whole lot of different reasons. And I looked at a whole lot of different opportunities. I could tell you I may not have picked the best one. I went over to Women.com as Chief Marketing Officer in Business Development. And from a career standpoint, I think I've always considered myself very much a marketer. And marketing is both on B2B, but especially B2C. And, of course, Match.com was very much a consumer play. And Women.com was interesting. Here's what I say sometimes, Pam. I did the good, the bad, and the ugly on back to the good. So Match.com was a game changer, much like eBay and a whole bunch of other companies, where they took something that was done one way, turned it into a whole new and different and dynamic thing online. And I think it made a difference in terms of impact on people's lives, and obviously it's a brand leader. I think it's a successful business from what I can tell at this point in time. I call Women.com the bad, not because it was a bad company, but at that time in 98, 99, it was very much about going public and riding the bubble. And so I think sometimes instead of focusing on building a really good media brand, we focused on having the kinds of partnerships and spending money to really get the attention so that we could have that kind of IPO. And that was not atypical of companies, a lot of companies in that era. And we did IPO, but by the time that happened, it was 1999, and by the time anybody could really profit from that personally or even the company, we were in the dot-com bust. In late 1999, I joined BlueLine.com, which was a joint venture between SoftBank Capital and Kmart for the, you know, the Blue Line special. And our whole idea there was to bring middle America really onto the internet, and we had a free ISP offering that we offered primarily through Kmart stores, but also through Yahoo and some other distribution partners. And I call that one the ugly because at that point, and this is before the dot-com bust, it was all about the money everywhere around. In fact, I think I had a six-figure marketing budget back then. So really kind of rode the wave of the different kind of internet companies, a different kind of models. I went from social networking to advertising-based to e-commerce. I think all three of them saw brand and marketing as really important to the objectives that they had in terms of either growth or financial objectives and so on, and I always believe that brand is very important. So I landed in Trustee in 2001. It's dot-com bust. I think I took a year off, spent some time with my kids, did the AIDS ride, which was a lot of fun, you know, from San Francisco to Los Angeles on the bike with some friends, and that was great. So it's 2001, and trustee is a nonprofit, is also going through its version of a bust, so a lot of customers were disappearing. In fact, my first board meeting was 2 days after 9/11, okay? And it wasn't clear that we were going to make it at all as a business. What I had with trustee, what I could see that we had, despite some changes in management and ups and downs and so on, was a brand that was meaningful. And my observation would be, Pam, that if a company was able to build a brand in 1997, 98, 99, you could do that online if you were smart about it without a whole hell of a lot of money, you know? And trustee was in that enviable position, even as a nonprofit, of having great customers and a fine reputation and doing something that's important to customers, which is to consumers, which is helping them make sure that their privacy is protected. And for companies, helping them show to consumers that they respect their privacy preferences.
What's striking me is you think about yourself as a marketer, obviously with a range of general management skills. At what point did you become conscious, Fran, I'm also a leader and I'm shaping my leadership journey?
That's a really good question. I think the first time probably was as general manager of Match.com. But I'll tell you, I was in the end, unfortunately, I think because Match.com wasn't really respected within the organization it was in, and because I was probably overworked, underpaid, and had two small children, I didn't take it to the next level, which would have meant, I think, that I would have found a way to have been one of the buyers and not sold it to send it, but perhaps put together my own company to run it. And I think looking back, I probably could have done it, but I didn't have the confidence or the energy. You know, it's kind of hard to say energy. I'm a very energetic person.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have the wherewithal to feel confident about it. And I think my do-over is taking trustee from nonprofit to for-profit.
Now, that happened 2 years ago?
Yeah, 2008. But it took a long time to make that happen. And in terms of background, trustee was established as a nonprofit in 1997. I think it made a lot of sense. The idea was, let's get some big companies together, some advocates and some others like EFF, and talk about what should consumers expect to get on the Internet in terms of a privacy policy and protection. So trustee was established at that time as a nonprofit. And in 2001, when I took it over, I was able to turn it around, really fix a lot of the issues that had to do with sales growth and product value and really putting more technology behind the solution. And by 2005, I think it was becoming clear to me anyway that we needed to put more technology. We need to address more privacy issues. We needed to serve our clients in a more professional manner, just things like giving them good reports on their business activities with us. And that even though we were cash flow positive through most of that period and had established some new programs, for example, to address the issue of trusted downloads, Spyware basically, and our answer was trusted downloads, we were undercapitalized. And as a nonprofit industry association, there was no way to get sort of grants or foundation money that I could not hire people like product managers and technology people because they want equity. And not only do they want equity, they want the ability to know that if they come up with a good idea, that we can implement it because that's what people want in those jobs, right?
Sure.
And I also knew that we really needed to expand and reach the small businesses and medium-sized businesses who really needed our services. And if we didn't do that, we would become a very boutique company, only serving the very largest of companies, and become more narrow and marginalized in our scope.
I'm guessing, Fran, that there were many, many conversations with your board, your team, to move the organization from nonprofit to for-profit, and that not all of those conversations were easy ones. What did you find yourself drawing on in terms of your skills, capacity, resilience as a leader?
You know, I think a number of things, and it's a good question, and I'll reflect on it a bit. I think, first of all, I had a vision, and still do, that this privacy stuff and consumer control over the information really matters. And I certainly knew from our client base that it mattered to companies as well, and I certainly knew, and I had a lot of fun, and I think it was very supportive for me to go talk to FTC and testify on some different kinds of committees and really get into the policy and the Washington aspect of this. And I found that I could really articulate the issues and be passionate about it in a way that maybe the lawyers or the typical policy folk didn't quite do. So I think I got some confidence from approaching this maybe from a mindset that is more marketing and business focused, but still very much committed to consumers as well.
So you had vision, you had passion. What else did you need to make it through that?
I needed help. And it helped me to know, and I think a lot of leaders think that they have to do things on their own. And I really, through the course of making that transition with the board, called on people within my team and outside to help me. I'll give you a couple of examples. I went out to the nonprofit community and I found, I think, two consultants, but one particularly, Lynn Lukow, who impressed upon to me and eventually to the board that the measure of a good nonprofit is impact. You know, what is their mission and how are they having impact? And rallying the board to understand that that was their job allowed us to filter our different strategic options and financial options through that lens of impact. And ultimately, I think it was the importance of impact that helped the board understand that the best thing for a trustee to do was to go ahead and get capital so that we could continue our mission in a way that made sense. So calling on people like Lynn to help with the board stuff, proving that we could do entrepreneurial things by, as somebody said about my team, that we were batting above average and taking on some new issues and making them happen. I think having good relationships with all the stakeholders so that when I finally got the board to say I could talk to outside people, other stakeholders, about this move from nonprofit to for-profit. I had a wonderful time talking to our clients and regulators and advocates and explaining to them why I thought this was the right thing to do and getting their feedback on it. And generally, everybody said, you know, and I mean almost everybody, that, hey, this sounds like the right thing for a trustee to do. And so that was very, very affirming.
So important, Fran, the point of having the relationships in place and investing in the relationships before those crucial decisions when you really, really need their support. What have you learned over your time as a leader in how to build those relationships?
I think building the relationships is, in the end, probably the number one thing anybody can do. And I think the ways that you build those relationships is really being present for those relationships. So, you know, positively engaging, making yourself go out and go to the events, the parties. You know, it can't all be email, right, and Facebook. Although I have to say Facebook and LinkedIn have really, really helped build those kinds of relationships and have also I think brought forth and made it more obvious to people how important networking and relationships are. Mm-hmm. The other word that comes to mind is authenticity and integrity. So, you know, it's important when you're out there that you're really you and you're expressing your points of view and, you know, and finally, Pam, you know, I'm an extrovert. I like to go talk to people. I like doing what I'm doing today with you. So that kind of stuff really helps. And I know it's hard for some other people. I clearly understand. So I guess I'd say that is people have to find their own way, but be authentic in it, you know?
makes sense. And, you know, a good part of why we're doing this is because you did reach out to have those conversations, you know, at the events that you chose to go to and to connect with GSB alums as well as people in your industry.
Well, and I think, I'm kind of passionate about the women in management thing. I have very few friends from undergrad and grad school who are still working. And it's shocking. And it's not because they all made a fortune. I think the frustrations are really, really high for women. And
in that case, Brian, let me share with you an experience I had last week as I was speaking with a group of mostly 20s to 30s corporate women, emerging leaders. And I asked, as I often do, how many of you, show of hands, 10 years from now, want to have a significant leadership role? And it was the lowest percentage I've ever seen, 25% hands went up. I said, okay, what's going on? And a lot of it was what you talked about earlier, saying have the confidence and have the energy to seem to make it worth climbing those mountains. And people said, you know, I see the leaders in our organizations are on their Blackberries, you know, 24/7, and that's not the life that I think I want, you know, 10 years from now. And it's almost like the excitement of having an impact and leading an organization and a community and an offering to the world doesn't seem great enough to overcome the logistical challenges of making it happen.
You know what I heard Sheryl Sandberg, maybe you were at that event.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And she said, too many people are giving up before they even get there.
Right. And I saw that so concretely.
Lines, right? That they're deciding this stuff that having children is going to be too hard to do before they have the children. You know, they're kind of dropping off before, you know, Pam, I don't know. I'm now in my mid-40s. I'm as driven as I've ever been. And, I know it's not just about financial reward. It's very much about impact. And it's very much about intellectual and social. You know, I think the things that drive me are a real combination. I think it's really hard. Like I said, back in 1997 when we were selling Match.com, I was so exhausted. And I'll tell you, my husband, it's not that he didn't pitch in. It was just I was beat up. I was unsupported within the company that, you know, I was exhausted, plain and simple.
That question of support is so crucial. And, you know, I know Trustee is trying to accomplish a lot of things. You've recently launched the Small and Medium Business Initiative. There's so much out there to go do in the world of online privacy.
Oh, and the traveling, too, is just nuts.
How do you stay resilient, and how do you help your people stay resilient?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think for me, earlier in this conversation, I talked about getting help, and I worked with an executive coach, and Lili King, good friend of mine now. And Lili helped me understand a few things about myself. So what happens when I get stressed? What are the bad behaviors I don't get into? And how to sort of counteract those things. And in a way, it gave me permission to take care of myself. So it gave me permission to listen to a lot of music because I guess my profile is I really like to listen to a lot of music. I've known that for years, but I used to sort of laugh about it. Now I understand that it's reaffirming for me. Cooking, working out, you know, make time for the things that kind of put you in a different place where you're not really thinking about the work stuff, but you're really focused on something very specific, you know, like I said, cooking. or skiing or taking some time. Try and find the things that give you energy rather than sap your energy away. And I'm just struggling with that right now. At Trustee, I think we're going through a lot of changes. I think probably my best use is to evangelize and form new relationships and help with the sales and provide some work with our policy and our government relations team. And that means I'm going to have to let go of some other stuff. And that's hard to do, but I've come to the conclusion it is the right thing to do. And I think that for my overall team, helping them understand what is your very best role that you want to do. And it's hard. This transition from nonprofit to for-profit, I think, has really made our organization have to move more quickly and be more commercially oriented and probably put in more hours. I think it's a challenge.
As you think about turning over to your team more and more of what it is that you've done, and for them to grow as leaders, how do you see your role in that? What are you doing to help them step up?
You know, I wonder if I'm doing enough. And I don't mean that they're not stepping up. It's just that it is a challenge. I think, again, it comes down to really being clear about what we're going for and what our priorities are and how important focus is on those things. I think it's imperative that is, they're told it and discuss it and tell it again. So the message about what we're doing and how we're doing it has to go out again and again and again. That we, as leaders within the company and my executive management team, that we really try to talk to other functions and work across the organization, not just within silos. That we celebrate the mini wins, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, there was a period of a few weeks there that was a celebration of a new release of a product or a new deal or a new revenue number being met. You have to, I think, celebrate the little things. At the same time, I think it's a challenge in a fast-growing and intense organization. Sometimes the bad news doesn't come forward or the challenges don't come forward soon enough. And I'd like that to happen more often.
You know, that's something that Peter Mello and I have talked a lot about on previous podcasts, that it's often so difficult as a senior team to get the information that you need. And while there, you know, are some technical remedies around knowledge systems, et cetera, really culture as being one of the most powerful levers that senior leaders have to treat the information that they get in ways that people say, okay, this is a safe place to send the bad news. How does that strike you?
I think it's really hard because I think everybody wants to say good news, right? The fact is, every organization has challenges, always, or something doesn't work out, or timing, whatever. And I try and reinforce that, oh, please don't surprise me, you know? Let's talk about it early. That this isn't about the people, this is about the challenge, right? So try and depersonalize it to the extent possible. Try and I think this is hard for us because as a nonprofit, we couldn't afford to have any to take some risk and fail. So failure wasn't really an option. And in the for-profit, because we're growing so fast and so on, it would be silly if we didn't make some mistakes. You know, that's one reason why you raise some money, so you can make some mistakes. Because if you don't make some mistakes, then you're not even going to get there. But I think that's been hard to kind of get through. And then people, I think it's kind of heightened by this environment, where the economic environment's so tough, people are just terrified about losing their jobs.
Yeah.
And so I think it just magnifies a natural reluctance not to share some of the challenges at times. So again, that's another message, and I think we have to, sometimes we have to be restrained in our criticism so that we can really get everything on the table.
Another thing that I frequently am talking with my clients about is what sort of agreements you have amongst each other as a senior team that signals to the rest of the organization that these are folks that are working together, that we're not in silos and we're not going to play a, you know, mom said, dad said kind of thing. What are some of the things that you and your senior team have talked about or worked out or are focused on so that you are as cohesive and in as good communication as possible with each other?
Yeah, so it's something like a lot of things we're constantly working on. I would say we have the benefit of a larger mission relating to the overall trust and privacy on the Internet. that helps check the egos at the door. So that's helpful, right?
Yeah.
So even though, sure, there's CEO and COO and VP this, VP that, we're all trying to do something really important. And die on that ball helps moderate some of the so, sometimes you see organizations that are really built around one person and or financial goals exclusively and so on, right?
And
so
you have a shared sense of purpose.
Yeah, good sense of purpose. I think the rest of the team needs to see the senior team meet a lot and discuss a lot. We've tried to build some processes around decision-making, for example, around new product releases or other kinds of changes. That's fairly transparent in terms of, you know, let's sit down and look at the deck or look at the memo and discuss it together so that we all know what everybody's point of view on, and we also all know what people's hesitations or support points are.
Speaking of transparency, you know, transparency now has means more than inside the organization with social media. It is a real question, how transparent can you be? Do you want to be outside the organization? And you mentioned LinkedIn and Facebook. How are you, your team, trustee, using social media to manage external relationships?
Yeah, it is now an integral part of our communications and marketing strategy. And, you know, I blog a bit. I probably should be blogging more. I Twitter a bit. I probably should be Twittering more. I do Facebook status updates, and I think I probably do that enough. And I actively, and we have fan pages or business pages on both LinkedIn and Facebook. And I think it's now required of a chief executive or a senior executive to do some of this stuff. Now, we spent some time coming up with guidelines. I think people have different voices and roles. It has been difficult to encourage many people in the organization to embrace it and to do it. So I'm always looking for, hey, why don't you, you know, somebody in the company might have a good idea or have had an interesting interaction, blog about this, you know, or Twitter about it. And it really has to become part of your day-to-day, just like checking email. And people's days are already really crowded, and then they're afraid of what will be the backlash, right? But I think it's something that everybody's got to start to experiment with. And if you're a leader in an organization, I don't think you have a choice.
Yeah.
Now, I think what you have choices are on that you need to consider is obviously you have to respect confidential information. You have to respect your company's information. You've got to feel for yourself what is your personal line and what is your business line. In other words, how much of your personal life do you want to bring into something? But I just don't see any way about not doing it, and I think at this point it's really hard to do enough of it.
Right, and a lot of companies are trying to figure out how many voices they can have speak for them and what's the role of the CEO.
Well, and it also goes back down to marketing, too. I'm probably misquoting. I can't even remember, but I was recently at something, and they said, you know, it used to be that companies thought they created brands, but it's actually now community and people who create brands.
Mm.
So what your brand is, sure, I'm not saying you can't influence that and try and position it and so on, but the context under which you build that brand is so much more a subject to the crowd.
Yeah.
And that's a paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I have a few questions for you, Fran, that we always ask our weekly leaders. And one is, what are you reading?
Oh, okay. I think I have a Kindle. So I've got a few books that I'm going back and forth on. Fiction, I'm reading Thread of Grace. It's about Italy in 1944 and a time when Italy had surrendered, but Germany hadn't left. And apparently a lot of Italians were trying to protect the Jewish community and refugees in Italy. So kind of a nice, interesting historical novel. I'm also reading the book Nudge, which is about decision-making and consumers. I think it has a lot to do with trustee.
Great. If you could lunch with a historical or contemporary leader, who would you want to be with and what would you want to learn or discuss?
Well, I know it's probably the most, I bet most common. I would love to sit down with Abraham Lincoln.
I don't know that we've had that said before. So that's
really
terrific. Yeah, what would you talk about?
I was fascinated. I've always liked his biographies, but I thought Doris Kearns, she wrote the book about Lincoln and his team, right, his cabinet. And what I learned in that book about Lincoln is how he kind of looked at the situation and was very strategic and pragmatic about decision-making on when to start the war, how to prosecute the war, when to do the Emancipation Proclamation. I would like to talk to him about his leadership style.
So would we. We haven't been able to arrange that interview,
I think that would be fascinating. And so I'm a big Abe Lincoln fan.
Thanks, Fred. To wrap things up, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today, what piece of advice would you share with aspiring leaders?
Study leadership. You know, spend some time thinking about who you admire, much like you just asked me. Listen to things like this. Read the books. Study leadership, but still come up with your own style. That's authentic and real to you.
And that is a wonderful note to close on. Thank you so much for being with us, Fran Meyer.
Thanks very much, Pam. It was a lot of fun.
Well, Pam, that was Fran's take on leadership. What were your thoughts or observations about the interview?
Well, as you can tell, it's really easy to talk with Fran, and part of the reason for that is I just find her open, candid, and really thoughtful about, you know, where she's been, what some of the struggles have been, and how she's working through it. I also love her passion for what she's doing.
Yeah, it's very interesting. She's obviously been in a very exciting industry, in a very exciting place, co-founder of Match.com, and at a time that really it was before its time when she was there, and she talked about that a bit. She comes off so incredibly authentic in the interview. I was very impressed, and she actually, you know, shared with us some of her challenges and some of the decisions she made along her career path that if she had a chance to go back and do it again, she might have taken a different course. So I thought that was really, really refreshing to hear somebody, a leader, talk about the opportunities that they might have missed or. But then again, you know, I also think she fully takes advantage of every time where she is at any point in time. So
I was struck by her talking about failure not being an option as a struggling nonprofit, and that now that they've switched to a for-profit structure, that's one of the reasons that you make money, that you raise money, is so that you can afford to try some things and fail. And I was just thinking more broadly in terms of this economy and people still not having money in their budgets is there's two things going on, right? People are talking about this is a great time to try it and fail. But yeah, if you're running on such slim margins that any decision bets the company, you can't really fail.
Definitely. And she talked about celebrating mini wins. We've talked about that before. Building momentum with small wins. And at times when things seem so bleak, sometimes the only thing you have are these small wins, and I think you can actually use those to tremendous advantage to keep momentum and build morale in an organization. It sounds like she's doing a good job there. Really embraces social media, and I thought it was interesting that she embraces it, but thinks that she might not be embracing it enough. So thinks maybe she should be on blogging more and Twittering more, and I think the only thing she felt she was doing enough was on Facebook.
I was also struck when she was talking about sharing information and transparency, and both outside the organization, bringing that in through social media, and inside the organization, and that especially at a time inside where people are concerned about taking risks, that senior leadership really needs to be open to the ideas that come forward and to be, I think she said, restrained in their criticism. Now, Fran is not someone who's ever struck me as someone who doesn't speak their mind, and I think you can hear that in the interview. But to remember as a senior leader to keep the framing that this person is bringing me valuable information. So even if I have trouble with some of the information, boy, do I want them to know that I'm glad they brought it to me.
We asked our typical questions, and one thing that just really, really jumped out at me, was very interesting, is her response to who she'd have a leader lunch with, and she felt that, you know, this one probably is used by a lot of people, and she chose Abraham Lincoln, who was obviously a tremendous choice. But that's the first time any of our weekly leaders actually have mentioned Lincoln. So I thought that was really interesting how sometimes we think, we anticipate, or we assume people are kind of making the same choices or have the same values that we do, and sometimes they don't.
You know, I think that actually ties in with a bias that we talked about a couple weeks ago, where people tend to believe that others share their views even more so than they actually do. So I thought what she had to say was unique and important.
Definitely. And I love the way she kind of closed out the podcast, or you guys closed out the podcast. You asked her any final thoughts, and she said, you know, just go out there and study leadership. And one of the things she said, listen to this podcast. I think she was saying listen to podcasts in general, but, you know, read and listen to podcasts and just find your authentic and real leadership style, which, it comes across with her, at least in this interview. I think, it was a fantastic interview. I think there's so much there for people who want to learn about leadership to really use to model.
Thanks, Peter. It was really a pleasure to talk with her.
Well, do you have any final thoughts this week?
Well, it's an exciting week for me because I'm doing my first official webinar as opposed to unofficial webinar, which I guess is, you know, meetings over the phone where you scramble to share your screen with other people. But this time it's going to be professionally facilitated and all very well put together. So I'm excited about that. That is with Type Labs. And if you go to typelabs.com, I think there's still opportunity to sign up for if people want to do that. It's going to be this Friday morning. It is called Really Me? Coaching People Through Type-Related Blind Spots. So if people are MBTI practitioners, you can get CEUs. It's also relevant to people who work with Enneagram or really work with any sort of personality type model about how to use that to help people see blind spots.
So is there a cost for the webinar?
There is, and you can go and see the pricing on Type Labs. I've been impressed with the field of people that he's put together, and I'm really glad to be a part of it.
Cool. Good luck with that. And we look forward to a report next week about your experience doing a webinar. Another great weekly leader interview. We appreciate it. And I look forward to chatting with you again next week.
Thank you, Peter.
We would love for you to join us in the leadership conversation, and we've given you lots of ways to do that. So head on over to weeklyleader.net and find the podcast posts and give us some feedback about what you heard here or what you'd like to hear in the future. You'll also find that we have a very talented team of bloggers who are passionate about the topic of leadership, and they'd love to hear from you too. So engage with them in the conversation. If you want to submit an audio comment, we would love to get your voice on the podcast. So you can send an email to podcast@weeklyleader.net, attach an MP3 file of 5 meg or less, and we'll find a way to integrate it into the show. We're all on Twitter, and Weekly Leader is @weeklyleader. Pam is at PamFR. I'm at Peter Mello, and that's PeterMello. And all of our other contributors' IDs will be in the show notes. If you use iTunes, we would really appreciate it if you would go over there and rate and review the podcast. This really helps us to get more listeners and to be featured in both the business category and more consistently in the marketing and management and marketing category. So thank you all who've rated and reviewed already, and anybody who's interested in supporting the show, we'd really appreciate that. We always use PodSafe music from Music Alley, which used to be PodSafe Music Network, and the intro is Transcends by Trance Blackmon. The song on either side of the Weekly Leader interview this week is by Samantha Farrell, and the song is Who to Trust. And finally, we're going to close out with another Samantha Farrell song called Keep Moving. So we know how valuable your time is, and we really thank you for investing it with us. We look forward to being with you next week.
Keep moving on.